Hello, hello, and welcome to Annotation, an audio project by me, Anne Friedman, that is kinda sorta related to my email newsletter, the Anne Friedman Weekly. Please subscribe if you don't already, but hey, you probably do. Thanks, and hello. So recently a friend of mine asked me about what small pleasures I was really clinging to during this period of confinement, and I instantly, without even thinking about it, replied, my first sip of coffee every morning. Every single morning. Okay, here's a short personal history of coffee. As a child, my dad drank it, like sometimes, most mornings maybe, but he was not devoted to it really. It was not like a part of his identity. It was not like a thing he woke up pining for. My mother was not interested in coffee, professing to love the way it smells, but hate the way it tastes. However, my aunts, who lived in Chicago and Los Angeles, respectively, called it nectar of the gods. And this, I think, was maybe my first indication that coffee was associated with some kind of adulthood I wanted for myself, specifically a kind of urban, wealthy adulthood. Something that felt exciting in the center of things. So of course, when I hit my teen years, I spent hours and hours at a strip mall coffee shop called Take Five, which sounds very whatever, a strip mall coffee shop, especially now in the globally dominant Starbucks era. But honestly, at the time, felt very alt and cool. And I would like trade CDs with the baristas who were older than me. And yeah, it felt very coastal elite, to use the parlance of our time, which was, again, everything I loved and aspired to be. And it would be another several years, I think, before the local Hy-Vee grocery store installed a Starbucks kiosk. In my 20s, when I had joined the ranks of the coastal dwellers, my mom used to mail me Starbucks gift cards. I mean, she knows I love coffee. True, fair enough. But I also think she kind of thought of it as the perfect small gift for an on-the-go career gal, busy city gal, even though then, as now, I mainly use them in airports. And today I have like a home pour over setup, which is kind of snobby, but I like to think I'm not that precious about it. Mostly I'm precious about that moment of sensory pleasure before I settle into productivity for the day. And let's be real, productivity is my real drug of choice. Coffee is like the drug that gets me to the deeper drug, the means to the end. So the appeal is, yeah, a little bit chemical. I'll come back to that later this episode. But most of my coffee experience is rooted in the cultural. That lone cup of coffee every morning is such an important ritual to me, one of the few to survive and thrive in this pandemic. And this week, my friend Bridget, who has been very close to me since those high school years, emailed to say that she recently thought she had been entering a depressive phase because coffee stopped tasting good to her. I called her to talk about it.
I was starting to get a little worried that I was getting really depressed again because I just wasn't enjoying coffee in the morning. And sometimes I actually thought it was incredibly disgusting, but I still drank it.
Take me back to like a normal day. What is your normal day experience with coffee?
I get up, and of course, I'm the first one to get up. So I start feeding my son breakfast. And as soon as I put his waffle in the toaster oven, and then I fill up my hot water kettle. And then once the toaster oven turns off, I turn the hot water kettle on because otherwise it will blow a fuse. And then I do the pour over method because I want that great taste. And then I drink sips while I'm getting ready for work and keep refilling as I'm pouring. And my husband hates this, but I will like lift up the grounds and start pouring into my mug before I'm finished making the whole coffee. But I just can't wait that long.
Okay, and so when and why did you start thinking that maybe you were depressed?
It was a couple months ago. It was before COVID, and I just was like, every time I would drink coffee, it was so gross. Like, it tasted horrible. Like, I was even buying, like, name brand and using good coconut milk. And, like, I just was like, this is awful. And it tastes like dishwasher soap. It tasted da-da. And I washed it out in vinegar, and I soaked it, and da-da-da, and everything. Tried to use a little, like, baby bottle scrubber things in the hole. And then, yeah, there's a certain button that clearly indicates that you should push it.
So you had just been poorly cleaning the lid of your to-go mug, is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, for years. For years, I had not cleaned that appropriately.
Do you think of it like a drug?
Yes, but even more so, it to me, it's definitely the ritual and like the transitional object and the comfort about it. Even when I come to work, then I get distracted by other things and I almost never finish my to-go mug of coffee. But I'd be really depressed and upset. Like I would drive back home if I forgot it.
Right. Even though you don't actually finish the whole thing. Because that's the thing for me, too. It's like the first sip of coffee is one of the most important moments of my day. And then also most days there is like an inch of cold coffee left in the bottom of my mug at the same time.
Oh, yeah. To me, it's also, I guess it's so much like smoking where like, yeah, that first drag is, oh, so good. And then you're like three drags in and you're like, oh, my God, this is so disgusting, but I don't want to waste it.
I have thrown away so much coffee in my life just because I needed like the work break of going to get it, or I don't know, like there's a million gallons of coffee just fully dumped by me because I needed the act of one sip. I'm glad coffee's making you happy again.
Oh, me too. Everything's just hard.
Everything's hard.
Doesn't it feel good when so many problems are complex and intertwined and totally unsolvable to hear about something so small and so concrete and so easily fixed? Anyway, I love that story. In a review of several books about coffee published recently in The New Yorker, Adam Gopnik writes about Augustine Sedgwick's book, Coffee Land, One Man's Dark Empire and the Making of Our Favorite Drug. Gopnik writes, American workers were compelled to drink the stuff, as Central American peasants were compelled to make it. The coffee lobby bought scientific studies to sell American industrialists on the notion that caffeine was the ideal productivity enhancer. One manufacturer served free coffee because, according to an industry advertorial, it ensured that workers would remain in peak form, keeping the standard set by the early morning hours more nearly stable for the rest of the day. If faith is the opiate of the masses, then coffee is their stimulant. Sedgwick suggests that profit-seeking bosses deliberately addicted American workers to the beverage in ways that recall the drug industry's dissemination of opioids to the same masses a century later. Of course, I knew that coffee was and is often produced by exploiting land and the people who have historically lived on it. But somehow it hadn't occurred to me that there was also a flip side to this, a concerted effort to push it onto the American masses.
The best part of waking up.
Of course, duh, Americans were groomed to be coffee drinkers. And I can't believe I hadn't thought of this in part because these days, I live with someone who does not drink coffee, but absolutely loves that first cup of tea in the morning because he grew up in a tea territory. Would you wear a shirt that says, but first, tea?
Definitely. It was the first thing that we used to do when things were difficult at home. Like we would have if our family were kind of going through a rough patch, we would come back to the house and the first thing like someone would inevitably say would be, put the kettle on.
How much of it is caffeine addiction and how much of it is cultural comfort?
0% caffeine addiction.
I mean, there's a lot of caffeine in tea. You're probably addicted.
Oh, I am probably mostly wired all day. I don't think about it like that.
But first, coffee. Can we talk about this phrase for a second? That fixture of Pinterest boards and Etsy mugs? Unlike so many similar phrases on the internet, this one actually has an origin story that you can Google. I read about it on a website called sprudge.com, which I disclosed to you as an accountability measure so you can take this information as seriously as you might take a website called sprudge.com. Who knows what their fact-checking policy is? Anyway, the story goes like this. The year was 2010. A 25-year-old designer and illustrator named Topher McCullough was reading the internet, specifically the blog Apartment Therapy, and he saw a post about, well, I'll just read you the headline, Genevieve and Maxwell's Mid-Century Perch. That sounds like every Apartment Therapy article from the early 2010s, but anyway. McCullough liked one of the photos of this home, which happened to be in Silver Lake, and he posted it to his Tumblr with the caption, maybe it's a good day for rearranging the office/dining room, but first, coffee. A friend of McCullough's named Colin Quinn reblogged the photo. God, I miss Tumblr. He reblogged the photo with just the last three words of the caption, but first, coffee. Then McCullough, who as I mentioned is a graphic designer, took those words, put them in a cute font, and posted just that phrase, those three words, to his Flickr page. A commenter asked if he would be putting this on a mug. Shout out to that unsung hero. A few days later, McCullough was selling But First Coffee drinkware on Zazzle. And then the internet ran with it. Google search trends, which people like to use to point to the popularity of things like this phrase, show that 2014 is the year it really took off. The year it kind of became ubiquitous on everything. Like, I think of this as one of those phrases where you're in the aisles of Target or Joanne or somewhere like that, and there's an end of aisle display, and there's a bunch of pointless crap that you don't really want, and it all has phrases like, but first coffee on it. So it became that. In 2015, McCullough wrote a reflection on But First Coffee. Quote, I gasped the first time I saw someone on the street wearing one of these shirts. Now I'm trying to be over it. To be honest, a lot of the versions people have made are more beautiful than my original, and that's one of the exciting things about the internet's natural urge to remix and repurpose. But I mean, it's not just the internet that is remixing and repurposing this. It's the same people who are kind of the modern versions of those who wanted to sell coffee to American workers. It's on murals and tote bags and lit up in neon on the wall of one particular coffee shop I visited once with a friend. I watched customer after customer come in, order, take their cup to go, and pause before leaving to photograph this neon But First Coffee sign. I asked the barista how many customers photograph it, and she told me, at least half. Starbucks even got in on the theme, albeit without directly lifting the phrase. I remember when I first saw, quote, that first sip feeling on a Starbucks cup, and I had that feeling like, oh, they got me. I hate it when a marketing phrase like actually nails something that I feel. It's the worst. You realize you're just like everybody else. Everyone loves this thing that you love too. I'm just like, I'm rolling my eyes at myself just remembering it. But of course we all love it because it's drugs. It's delicious, delicious drugs. According to a New York Magazine article from 2008, caffeine is the world's most widely used psychoactive substance because it works, and quickly. Caffeine enters the bloodstream almost instantaneously upon ingestion. This tracks with my personal experience, by the way. Within 30 to 45 minutes, it has permeated nearly every cell in the body. Because it slips effortlessly across the blood-brain barrier, a sort of filter that prevents bacteria, viruses, and most drugs from entering the brain, it penetrates the cerebral cortex unimpeded. Once inside the central nervous system, caffeine is believed to plug up the receptors of adenosine, a neuromodulator that acts like a brake on nerve cells, firing their messages across synapses. With the neural sluice gates open, more messages flood through, resulting, it's said, in a sense of heightened mental quickness. I'm like, yes, coffee's delicious, but wow, that is appealing to me. On a related note, the Starbucks logo is a, quote, twin-tailed mermaid or siren. And according to a website even more suspect than Sprudge.com that I can't even bring myself to name here, the logo was used by the original Starbucks founders to, quote, lure coffee lovers from everywhere. Lure them with what? To quote translator Emily V. Wilson, who tweeted a long thread about the sirens in The Odyssey and the ways they've been misunderstood and mistranslated, the seduction they offer is cognitive. They claim to know everything about the war in Troy and everything on Earth. They tell the names of pain. I don't know about the last part, but I will say that what is coffee but cognitive seduction? I cannot wait to be seduced tomorrow morning. Special thanks for this episode go to Whitney Mower, who wrote and played all the music that you're listening to. She releases music under the name They Live and has a new album out that you can find on Bandcamp or Spotify or wherever you are buying music in this pandemic. Special thanks as well to my BFF, Bridget Sicchio, my favorite tea drinker, William Lynn, and to all of you for listening. And I'll be back at some point with another episode of Annotation. You can find the newsletter in the meantime at my website, annfriedman.com.